Hello, friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Thursday, July 30th. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and here is our first story. Story County sees 5 new COVID-19 cases. This story written by Robbie Sequeira. Story County saw an increase of 5 positive COVID-19 tests as of 10 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday, according to state health officials. No additional deaths were reported in the county as of Wednesday morning. To date, a total of 11 county residents have died as a result of the virus, according to the state. At 10 o'clock on Wednesday, a total of 1,061 residents had tested positive for COVID-19, which is an increase of 5 cases over a 24-hour span. Of those who have tested positive in the county, 769 residents have recovered from the virus, according to data from Iowa's website. In Story County, state health officials reported that Acura Healthcare of Ames, which is identified by the state as having an outbreak in early July, has a total of 52 positive cases as of Wednesday, which is an increase of 1 case since Tuesday. Of those who have tested positive from the virus at the facility, 20 have recovered, according to the state's website. As of Wednesday morning, a total of 11,713 Story County residents have been tested for the virus, according to the state. Across Iowa, 3 additional deaths were reported on Wednesday, bringing the state death total to 839. As of 10 o'clock in the morning Wednesday, an additional 458 confirmed cases have been reported by state health officials, bringing the total to 43,196 in Iowa. Of those who have tested positive for the virus, a total of 31,196 Iowans have recovered from COVID-19. Our next story, Iowa State University announces retirement incentives, and President Winterstein takes a 10% pay cut. This story written by Kylie Wellendorf. Iowa State University will offer new early retirement options for staff in response to declining student enrollment and a drop in funding from the state. Overall, university leaders expect the coronavirus pandemic will cost the school about $114 million through the end of the 21 fiscal year. Our financial challenges cannot be understated, Iowa State University President Winterstein told the Board of Regents on Wednesday. The revenue loss for fiscal year 21 is more than $41 million. Since the start of COVID-19 through August 23rd, additional revenue losses and costs are estimated to be another $73 million. The retirement incentive, which was approved by a regents meeting during Wednesday, will offer 3 options to eligible employees. First, 2 years of retirement contributions plus health and dental coverage. Next, 3 years of retirement contributions. And next, 3 years of health and dental coverage. Approximately 1,200 faculty and staff will be eligible. That's nearly 20% of non-student employees. As part of the incentive, active employees with the university are eligible if they have continuous service and age that equals to 70 and are at least 60 years of age at the time of retirement and do not have already been accepted into a retirement program within the university. Staff can express interest in the incentive between August 3rd and March 1st of 2021. The incentive, I should restate that, August 3rd, 2020 and March 1st, 2021. The incentive program, Winterstein told Regents, will allow us to achieve the kinds of budget reductions we need. In addition to the early retirement program, Iowa State University has also reduced the budget by 5% for fiscal year 21, which will take away performance-based raises for staff and merit increases consistent with contract negotiations, along with a 2% reduction to retirement matches. Winterstein will take a 10% cut in her salary, which Regents President Michael Richards said will amount to $59,000 in reduction from August 1st, 2020 through June 30th, 2021. All of the leadership has made significant sacrifices, and I appreciate that, Richard said. The university is expecting to lose 100 faculty positions, primarily due to attrition, retirement, and unfilled vacancies. The loss of professional, scientific, and merit staff positions, as well as a reduction in both student employment opportunities, undergraduate research opportunities, and reduced educational programs and services for Iowans to use via extension and outreach. And I'm only going to read the beginning of this next story since it comes through the Des Moines Register. Iowa's public universities take a $65 million budget cut. Iowa's three public universities will take a fixed $65 million hit this budget year as a result of declining enrollment amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, on top of an $8 million cut in state funding approved by the legislature last month. The Iowa Board of Regents unanimously approved a $1.5 billion general operating budget for the schools Wednesday afternoon that includes $729 million for the University of Iowa, $629 million for Iowa State University, and $170 million for the University of Northern Iowa. Our next story, a pandemic causes Colo's Neelands Cafe to shut down. This story by Kylie Mullen. Colo's historic Neelands Cafe is preparing to permanently close its doors due to struggles caused by the coronavirus pandemic, despite more than a year of success in the community under the current ownership. The cafe and neighboring Colo Motel will have their last day of business on August 8. Owner Charity Starbuck said it was a difficult decision to shut down the business, which opened its doors under her management in March 2019, but it was a decision that had to be made. COVID has completely cut out a lot of our business, Starbuck said. We've lost like 70% of our customers. We had lots of regulars who would come in, but due to COVID and the scares of it, they're just not coming in anymore. That was one of the big deciding factors because I cannot keep my doors open if I'm not bringing any money in. There were also repairs needed for the building and motel, which Starbuck said the group in charge is not planning to make soon. That kind of made the decision final. We just can't safely stay open if things aren't going to get fixed, she said. Neelands Cafe is located in a restored gas station beside Colo Motel at the junction of Lincoln and Jefferson Highways near Colo. Starbuck and her husband, Arlo, moved to Colo when they took over both businesses from the previous owner last year. The buildings are owned by the Colo Development Group. The couple wanted to continue a family tradition of restaurant success, as Arlo is the grandson of Nevada's Starbuck Drive-In founders, Daryl and Jean Starbuck. It was going well, Charity Starbuck said, as the business had been popular with locals and tourists alike. Really, we had a great year. We tripled the business compared to what it had been in the years before, she said. We had redecorated everything, made it into a fresh new place, and people were loving it. They still love it. It's just because COVID, which made people not want to come out anymore, that we had to close. But they didn't give up without a fight. The couple did everything they could to make it work, Starbuck said. When Governor Reynolds declared on March 17, just 2 weeks after the cafe celebrated its first anniversary, that restaurants must close for dine-in service, Neelands Cafe immediately switched to takeout. Then, as soon as it was allowed to reopen, it did, offering both dine-in and takeout options. When Starbuck realized people were not eating breakfast as often, she adjusted the cafe's hours. The couple even received a few months of rent assistance from the city of Colo and a grant from the state to help them get through the closure. And it really helped us stay open about 2 months longer than we would have been able to otherwise, Starbuck said. But none of the changes were enough to save the business, and Starbuck decided it was time to throw in the towel. Despite the bitter end, Starbuck said she is proud of everything that they accomplished since the business opened. I love this. My passion is making food and making people happy with my food, so this has been an extremely hard decision. We've had a lot of comments from people about how much they love our food how they can feel that passion in the food, Starbucks said. To hear that we've accomplished that, that has been really rewarding. It's very sad overall, but we're very thankful that we had the opportunity. Amber Olson of Nevada said that she was so sad to see the announcement of Neyland's closing. They have amazing home-cooked food with a fun and unique atmosphere. My son loved their cinnamon roll the best, Olson said. I feel so bad about the strain these small businesses have had to endure during this time. I hate to see them close, as I know they put their hearts and their souls into this place. Starbucks said her family will be moving out of Colo, and though she did not specify where her next adventure would be, she said she's not ready to leave the restaurant business behind. This is not the end for me. Hopefully, I can open something up again somewhere and be able to have some of those employees or customers still come back to see us there, she said. It'll take some time because we put everything we had into this place, and now we have to start all over again. But, you know, when we build up those funds, we will hopefully start something new again. Starbucks said she is thankful to all those who have supported the cafe and the motel over the past 17 months, and she hopes everyone in the community will stop by for a taste and a goodbye in the days leading up to its closing. Available items will be changing as they use the stock that they have. We've kind of built a family atmosphere here, and people love coming, so a lot of people are quite upset that we are not going to be here, she said. We're absolutely going to miss all of our customers. Without them, we wouldn't be here. Joni Jameson, president of the Colo Development Group, said she is thankful for the time the Starbucks spent in Colo and the progress that they made with the business. A search for the building's next tenant is already taking place, and the goal is to continue the business as a cafe and motel. We are hoping to have somebody to run it. However, we don't know if that's possible in this world right now with COVID. So that is still our goal, but if that's not possible, then we are trying to think out of the box for other things that we could do here, Jameson said. No matter what, we still keep it our historical site there on the corner. And our final story from the front page, the Boone Welcome Train pulls into a new home. This story by Sarah Jordan Heinz, a contributing writer to the Tribune. What was once a dream of the Boone Rotary Club has become reality. To honor the town's rich railroad legacy, the club raised funds to install a historic train at the intersection of Highway 30 and Story Street. The number 17, a 280 steam train, was donated by the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad. A Canadian locomotive company built it in 1940 for the Robervale and Sequani Mining Railroad in northern Quebec. It was the last 280 built in Canada. The BSVRR purchased the steam engine in 1987 with the idea of using it for normal service, but it was discovered it would need costly repairs. Our centennial year, is 2019-2020, and we wanted to do something to celebrate being a service club in Boone for 100 years, Boone Rotary Club President Matt Elthen said. The Rotary Club of Boone, sponsored by the Rotary Club of Fort Dodge, was chartered on February 25, 1919. This display will welcome visitors to the city and serve as a reminder of our community's strong railroad heritage, dating back 155 years to 1865, when the Chicago and Northwestern Railroad platted it, the BSVRR posted on social media. Fundraising began in 2017, shortly after the club decided on the project. Due to the railroad heritage here, it just made sense, Elthen added. We wanted to make sure it's a lasting landmark that people could see to help Boone grow, having the train face into town. The train was repainted and refurbished. Last week, the complex task of moving the locomotive to its new permanent home commenced. On July 22, the passenger car and coal tender were moved. The next day, the steam engine was loaded up around 10 o'clock in the morning, and it traveled down Story Street and then reached its final destination at about 6:30 in the evening. We had a few hiccups getting it loaded, Elthen said. All passenger cars are a little different. The movers didn't get the passenger car and the coal tender until 6 p.m. Wednesday, and they didn't finish until about 2 a.m. on Thursday morning. There's some work still to do. A Welcome to Boone sign will be painted on the coal tender, and donors and sponsors will be recognized with signage. The number 17 will be added to the train to mark its origins. Elton said trees and landscaping would be added, as well as lighting, a sidewalk, and benches. Since the train is on Department of Transportation land, it was decided the train should be for display only and not allow folks to climb on board. A formal dedication ceremony will take place in the fall, Elton said, who assumed duties as Rotary President July 1st. He credits his predecessors with the success of the project. It was past presidents Vicky Greco and Lisa Mott who got it going, he said. The total cost of the project is $225,000, with the Boone Rotary Club having raised more than $175,000. To make a donation, you can send a check to Rotary Welcome Train, Post Office Box 532, Boone, Iowa, 50036. And for more information, you can visit www.boonerotary.com, or you can contact boonerotary@gmail.com. Turning inside the Tribune now, a Associated Press story. The United States is going to bring home 6,400 troops from Germany and move 5,600 more. Spurred on by President Donald Trump's demand to pull troops out of Germany, the United States will bring about 6,400 forces home and shift about 5,600 to other countries in Europe, American defense leaders said on Wednesday, detailing a Pentagon plan that will cost billions of dollars and take years to complete. The decision fulfills Donald Trump's announcement and desire to withdraw troops from Germany, largely because of its failure to spend enough on defense. A number of forces will go to Italy, and a major move would shift U.S. European Command Headquarters and Special Operations Command Europe from Stuttgart, Germany, to Belgium. The future of the plan is uncertain, at best, since it relies on support and funding from Congress, and a number of members have voiced opposition. And it may not survive at all if Trump is not reelected. Lawmakers have condemned the troop cuts as a gift to Russia, fueled by Trump's spite at Germany. But Defense Secretary Mark Esper defended the plan Wednesday, saying that while the decision was accelerated by Trump's orders, the move also will promote larger strategic goals to deter Russia, reassure European allies, and shift forces further east into the Black Sea and Baltic regions. We're moving forces out of Central Europe, Germany, where they've been since the Cold War, Esper said, adding that it will shift U.S. forces east, closer to Russia, where our newest allies are. Trump, however, reasserted his very narrow reason Wednesday, telling reporters, "We're reducing the force because they're not paying their bills. It's very simple. They are delinquent." He added that he might rethink the decision to pull troops out of Germany if they start paying their bills. Trump has repeatedly accused Germany of failing to pay bills, which is a misstatement of the issue. NATO nations have pledged to dedicate 2% of their gross domestic product to defense spending by 2024, and Germany is still short of that goal by about 1.4%. Esper said the military moves will cost in the single-digit billions of dollars, though bringing the troops home could reap some future deployment savings. Some smaller units could move within months, and the plan leaves about 24,000 troops in Germany. 22 Republicans on the House Armed Services Committee, 22 Republicans on the House Armed Services Committee sent a letter to Trump saying, "A reduced U.S. commitment to Europe's defense would encourage Russian aggression." And here's an opinion piece written by Mary Wiswinski. She writes for the Chicago Tribune, and it is titled, "Back to Church, the weird, comforting feeling of being together again in the COVID-19 era. I've been going to church again, and it's weird. Not bad weird or good weird, just surreal weird, like a banana with a mustache. It's like a lot of things during this pandemic, not quite good enough, but better than nothing, and the best we can do. It's a little bit tiresome and a little bit funny. Chicago's houses of worship started opening again in late June, but with lots of rules to prevent the spread of coronavirus. At first, only 50 people were allowed in our Roman Catholic Church at a time, according to the Archdiocese of Chicago's rules, and everyone had to be masked and keep 6 feet of distance. The crowd limit has since risen to 75, with the same rules in place, but the numbers have not gone that high yet. People are nervous, or they don't want to sit in a hot building in a face mask for an hour. The Sanctus, Gloria, and other parts of the Mass are being spoken, not sung, by the congregation to avoid the spread of the virus. Hymns are sung only by a cantor with a pianist accompanying. People have to register to go to Mass as if they were reserving a table at a chic restaurant and get checked out before they go in so we know who was there and allow for contact tracing in case someone gets sick. Eager for any kind of change, I signed up at my Northwest Side Parish to be one of the social distancing volunteers who make sure everyone's following the rules. We stand at the back, squirt sanitizer into cupped hands as people enter the building, give masks to the maskless, and check off names. Then we go up front during communion to direct traffic, and we spray people's hands again with another quick drying sanitizer before they receive the Eucharist. While distributing the host, the pastor wears both a mask and a clear plastic face shield, so he looks like a cross between a cleric and a Blackhawks goalie, as in hockey. Churches, like grocery stores, are decorated coronavirus style with duct tape on the floors, telling you how far to stand apart and which direction to go. In our parish, blue duct tape arrows point you up the center aisle towards the altar, and green tape marks 6 foot distances. On the side aisles, arrows make of yellow tape point you the way out. On the pews, blue tape crisscrosses mark which pews can be used and which ones cannot. After Mass, more masked volunteers show up to clean the pews where people have sat and the door handles they touched. Everywhere is the smell of disinfectant. When I'm not on hand sanitizer duty, I cantor, singing from the ambo, but I miss the choir. Who knows when we can get together again? It's strange to look out on all those masked faces as though we were holding service in a typhoid ward or during the London Blitz. I wonder if people are singing along silently in their heads. Sitting in the hot church on a recent Sunday with my mask, fanning myself with the petitions, I remembered a nun I had in grade school, Sister Harriet, a tough old bird with a gift for allegory. She used to compare the Eucharist to a diamond. She told us, "It doesn't matter what you do with a diamond, it's still a diamond. You can mount it in a beautiful ring, surround it with rubies, or you can stick it into a piece of cardboard with scotch tape. It's still a diamond. Just pretend in a different way. Just present it in a different way." You can have Mass in a cathedral with golden chalices, and a big choir, and everyone dressed up, or you can have it in a tent in the jungle with everyone in rags. The Eucharist is the same. That's what's important. Mass in masks, or music concerts on Zoom, or birthdays with a car parade, or anything else that's been changed and reduced because of the coronavirus, are like that diamond taped to a piece of cardboard. They're kind of ugly and awkward and not right, Not what we're used to, not what seems proper, but they're still all also okay. We're still being human together while being responsible for each other's safety, because that's what the pandemic rules are about, caring for each other beyond our own comfort. The mask wearing and the social distancing and the tape on the floors are clumsy reminders of the ideal of all religions, to love one another as we love ourselves, to be each other's servants, and we laugh to keep from crying. Here's hoping it's a lesson we can carry beyond the pandemic, whatever the day becomes. And here's the Dennis and the Menace comic for today. Mom and Dennis have just arrived home and they're carrying a lot of packages, a lot of packages. Dennis is carrying some, Mom is carrying some, Dad is sitting in a chair, and they open the door and they come in the house, and Mom says, "He's easy to shop for. He wants everything." And here's the real life comic for today. Two men appear to be at work. They're walking down the hallway, perhaps away from a meeting, and maybe away from a customer meeting, and they're in ties. And the one fellow says to the other, "Well, as Sinatra suggested, I did it my way. Unfortunately, the client ruled against my way and suggested the highway." And here's the non sequitur comic for today. Spouse, husband, significant other is sitting in the living room. He's reading his newspaper. He's got a dog, a crazy looking dog, sitting on the carpet next to him. And his wife is in another room. There's an archway between them that goes from one room to the other. And the wife, or significant other, whatever, she's building a brick wall in the archway. And she's got it built about shoulder high. And she's saying to the spouse, "My therapist told me to work on my boundaries, but to leave a line of communication open." And here's the coronavirus news briefing for today. Florida reported its largest one-day death toll yet, while California, Florida, and Texas were among states suffering their largest one-week death tolls. The United States hit 150,000 total deaths and has reported nearly 4.4 million cases of the coronavirus, according to Johns Hopkins University. Worldwide, there have been over 662,000 deaths and 16.8 million cases. Barely 2 months ago, the U.S. fatality stood at 100,000. Wednesday was the second record day for COVID-19 deaths in Florida, according to the state's Department of Health. The 216 fatalities marked the first time deaths have surpassed 200 and brings the state death toll to 6,333. If the state averages 200 fatalities per day, the total death toll would be more than double by Labor Day. The surge comes less than 2 weeks before some public schools begin their new school year, amid pressure from state officials to provide in-class education. The number of new cases increased by 9,446 Wednesday, marking the 36th consecutive day the state has recorded more than 5,000 new cases. There was a modest silver lining. The state has recorded 4 straight days with less than 10,000 new cases, the first time that has happened since July 6 through 9. Fatalities climb in most populous states. California, Florida, and Texas were among 9 states recording a record number of deaths over a 7-day period that ended Tuesday, a USA Today analysis of Johns Hopkins data shows. 9 states also set records for newly confirmed cases. Arkansas had a dubious distinction of being on both lists. The state had newly confirmed cases and 54 deaths. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom said the virus is disproportionately impacting Latinos, particularly in the state's Central Valley. Newsom unveiled a proposed $52 million plan for 8 Central Valley counties to help expand disease investigation, contact tracing, and quarantine efforts. A Houston doctor who has made outrageous claims and appeared on a video retweeted by President Trump was sued for malpractice after a woman she treated in Louisiana passed away last year, the Houston Chronicle reported. In the video, Dr. Stella Emanuel touts the coronavirus-fighting virtues of hydroxychloroquine, a malaria drug that Trump has repeatedly promoted, even though federal regulators last month revoked authorization of its use as an emergency treatment amid growing evidence it does not work and can have deadly side effects. "You don't need masks. There is a cure," Emmanuel says in the video, which Twitter and Facebook took down because it spread misinformation. "You don't need people to be locked down," she said. Emmanuel, who has said some medical conditions can be caused by having sex with demons, was sued in January. She and another doctor treated a Louisiana woman named Leslie Norvell, who said she had part of a hypodermic needle stuck in her arm, the newspaper reported. Norvell died 6 days later. One of the most promising approaches to treating COVID-19 has failed in a large clinical trial. Tocilizumab, I'm going to spell that T-O-C-I-L-I-Z-U-M-A-B, sold under the brand name Actemra, A-C-T-E-M-R-A, had been expected to be effective against severe infections because it tamps down the immune overreaction that often takes place in those patients. The results are not yet published, but Genentech, which manufactures Actemra, announced Wednesday that its large phase 3 trial did not improve results for patients hospitalized with severe COVID-19 or reduce deaths. Researchers found some indication that the drug might reduce the time those patients spent in the hospital, but the difference was not significant. You have been listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. William Roy Young, age 65, passed from this life Tuesday, July 28, as a result of COVID-19 complications. There will be a private family viewing August 1 at Grandin Funeral and Cremation Care. A graveside service will follow at 11 o'clock at Ames Municipal Cemetery. Face masks and social distancing are required. Feel free to bring a lawn chair. Roy was born August 9, 1954, in Des Moines, to Mary Olson and James H. Young. The family moved from Bedford to Ames when he was in grade school. He graduated from Ames High School in 1972. Roy served 4 years in the Marine Corps, attaining the rank of Sergeant E5. His primary specialty was artillery, scout, observer, and he earned the Rifle Expert Badge and Pistol Expert Badge. He was honored to be on a Freedom Flight in 2015. Roy and Deborah Michaud Cannon were married September 17, 1982, in Ames, where they raised their three children, Leah and Craig of Pleasant Hill, Michael and Megan of Grand Meadow, Minnesota, and Matthew and Erin of Grimes, Iowa. Along with his dad, Roy owned and operated Jarco stores at Lincoln Way and Duff Avenue until health issues forced his early retirement. Then he owned and managed commercial and residential properties. Roy served on the Zoning Board of Adjustment and Planning and Zoning Board with the City of Ames. He was an avid NASCAR fan, competitive bowler. He built and raced go-karts with his sons, and he loved riding his Harley Davidson. He was a member of the American Legion Riders. In addition to his wife, Deborah, and children, Roy is also survived by his five grandchildren, Camille and Elsie Skinner, Coraline, and Charles Young, and Lillian Young. Also surviving is his father, James of Ames, and three siblings, James E., Jean, and Marjorie of Cedar Rapids, Karen Schultz of Des Moines, and Peggy and Brad Mobbies of West Des Moines, as well as many nieces and nephews and cousins. His mother, Mary D. Young, preceded Roy in death. If you wish to make a memorial donation, please consider Israel Family Hospice House in Ames. Online condolences may be directed to GrandinFuneralAndCremationCare.com. Our next obituary, Willard Bill Hindraker, age 94, formerly of Radcliffe, Iowa, passed away Tuesday, July 28, at Northridge Village in Ames. Willard Maynard Bill Hindraker was born December 16, 1925, on the Hindraker Century Farm north of Radcliffe, Iowa. Bill and his wife, Anna Jane Birkenstrad, were married for 70 years. They raised their family on the farm, and they loved their time there until the couple retired and moved to town in 1990. Bill and Anna Jane's family include 5 children, 13 grandchildren, and 11 great-grandchildren. Details are available at www.bokeyfuneralhomes.com. A World War II veteran and community leader, Willard lived his faith, cherished his family and friends, loved his community involvement, honored his country, lived and loved well. He was well-loved. Willard passed away on Tuesday, July 28, at his home at Northridge Village in Ames, Iowa, with family at his side. He will be honored with a visitation on Friday, July 31, from 5 to 7 p.m., funeral service on Saturday, August 1st at 10:30 in the morning, both at Our Savior Lutheran Church in Radcliffe, Iowa. Interment will be held at the Radcliffe Cemetery immediately following, with a funeral service on Saturday. Friends and family are welcome and also invited to a socially distanced, individually packaged lunch following services on Saturday. CDC guidelines are encouraged, and the wearing of masks is suggested for the safety of all. Blessed be the life and memory of Willard Maynard Hindraker. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed to American Legion Post 317 Building Fund. Bokey Funeral Home of Radcliffe is in charge of arrangements. For more information and online condolences, you can go to bokeyfuneralhomes.com. And here's a book review that might be of interest. Jeopardy host Trebek searches for answers. This story comes to us from the Associated Press. The answer is Reflections on My Life by Alex Trebek. And the publisher is Simon & Schuster. Alex Trebek is the one providing the answers and questions in a new memoir that should reinforce admirers' expectations about the ever-steady Jeopardy host. The concise chapters with titles including What is a Mentor? And The Answer is Family, and ranging from a few paragraphs to a few pages, make for a readable but not splash-dash approach. The sum of the parts echoes the public figure, the genial and even courtly man that viewers have been watching on the Jeopardy quiz show since 1984. The fan support and affection that greeted Trebek's 2019 pancreatic cancer disclosure encouraged him to write about his life. But the illness and its toll, while honestly addressed, do not dominate the book. Instead, the Canadian-born Trebek focuses on his roots as the child of an immigrant father and a French-Canadian mother, the work ethic that he earned from TV success, and the contented marriage that he shares with Jean, now also his caregiver as he undergoes treatment. There are engaging tidbits about Trebek's former love for flashy cars. He drives a more utilitarian pickup truck these days. The satisfaction that he gets out of playing home handyman, the contestants that he admires, and the one that he bonded with. He is uniformly self-depreciating, including telling a story on himself that involves Britain's Queen Elizabeth II, and suggesting modesty that he's known but not celebrated. Instead, he writes, he's like a visiting relative that the audience finds comforting and reassuring as opposed to being impressed by me. A couple of minor foes in his life get dinged, including a marionette of a priest at a church-run school and a producer who stiffed him, but if he's harboring deep hostility, it isn't revealed here. His even disposition appears to have served him well and consistently over his 80 years. He was born July 22, 1940. Trebek's philosophical bent emerges clearly in the memoir as he shares his perspective on human nature, spirituality, and the value of knowledge. Our next story, Guatemala is burying dozens of unidentified COVID-19 dead. This is an Associated Press story. Guatemalan hospitals say they have to bury dozens of COVID-19 victims who have never been identified, and one hospital is creating archives in the hopes that once the pandemic passes, their relatives will come looking for them. Workers at one of the country's largest public hospitals have started photographing patients who arrive alone and too sick to give their personal details. Those who die unidentified are placed in body bags with transparent windows over their faces in case relatives finally arrive. Protocols that call for rapidly burying the dead include a pandemic, only make the situation more difficult, officials say. The government has reported more than 47,000 confirmed infections and more than 1,800 deaths nationwide. The first of 63 unidentified dead at the San Juan de Dios Hospital, one of the capital's largest, passed away April 25th. She was in her 20s and was buried the same day. Byron Fuentes, director of the Public Health Ministry's Public Cemetery Administration, said that so far, no one has come forward seeking any of the 41 men and 22 women that they have buried, identified only as XX. The hospital declined to comment on how it handles those who die unidentified. At Roosevelt Hospital, another of Guatemala's largest, Dr. Luis Chavez, head of pathology, said staffers have been looking for ways to help relatives eventually identify the dead. They started using body bags with windows with the hope that relatives arriving any time before burial could identify someone because, for health reasons, the bags cannot be opened, Chavez said. We had a case some weeks ago of a person who arrived in a taxi, he said. It was a woman. They admitted her to the hospital, and she died. She was taken to the morgue as XX. He said hospital workers broke protocol to wait 2 days, and fortunately, relatives arrived. They were shown a photograph taken through the window in her body bag and identified her, he said. The hospital started using a refrigerated trailer to hold bodies if relatives can't arrive in the 6 hours the protocols allow for claiming a body after death. No hospitals appear to be taking advantage of a national identity database that contains the fingerprints of anyone with a national identity card, a registry spokeswoman said, in search of the National Registrar of Persons. It would only be possible with an order from a judge, prosecutors, or forensic medicine officials. One death certificate viewed by the Associated Press showed the person identified only as XX, 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 with the gender and the estimated age, for cause of death, if listed acute respiratory distress syndrome and COVID-19. For now, the unidentified COVID-19 victims are buried in a designated area deep in the capital's Verbena Cemetery, surrounded by trees and near a settlement of impoverished housing. Unadorned graves are simply marked with a number. For relatives who may one day seek out their loved ones, there is little to go on. Officials estimate an age, record the gender, and the hospital where they arrived. Relatives would have to provide information to match those limited details, said Fuentes, the cemetery's chief. Even then, confirmation would be complicated. The law establishes that when someone dies from a quarantined illness, they cannot be exhumed, he said. The same law gives us an exception, but it is on a judge's order, and the judge would be the one responsible. And some news from around the nation. In Birmingham, Alabama, Space Camp, an educational program attended by nearly 1 million people, including a dozen who went on to become astronauts or cosmonauts, said Tuesday it is in danger of closing without a cash infusion because of the coronavirus pandemic. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom is using new powers to withhold money from two cities in the Central Valley that are defying his health orders by allowing all businesses to open during the pandemic. Newsom blocked nearly $65,000 from Atwater in Merced County and more than $35,000 from Coleguinia in Fresno County, the first installments of $2.5 billion in federal funds that cities and counties across the state risk losing if they do not toe the line on coronavirus safeguards. In Connecticut, Governor Ned Lamont and Acting Department of Public Health Commissioner Dr. Diedrich Gilford said they are worried about recent clusters of teens and younger people in Connecticut testing positive for COVID-19. In Georgia, many Georgia hospitals are groaning under the assault of COVID-19 infections, with total hospitalizations from the illness remaining above 3,000 statewide on Tuesday for the 10th day in a row. In Hawaii, although Hawaii has one of the lowest rates of cases per capita in the country, and many schools have open-air campuses, the challenges of returning children full-time to classrooms might still be insurmountable. In Idaho, organizations that advocate for schools, counties, county sheriffs, and businesses said Tuesday they want lawmakers called back into session to create a liability shield for protection against COVID-19-related lawsuits. In Illinois, Illinois college and university professors are pushing back against their school's proposals for reopening schools amid the pandemic, prompting officials to adopt new norms to accommodate faculty recommendations. And in Iowa, the corrections department announced the death of another inmate who was infected with the coronavirus. Timothy Lewis McGee, Jr., age 48, was pronounced dead Monday night, the corrections department said. In Kansas, the Lawrence School District has decided to start its school year after Labor Day with at least 6 weeks of online learning because of the pandemic. In Louisiana, payments start going out this week to Louisiana's frontline workers who remained at grocery store checkouts, in healthcare facilities, and on bus routes in the first months of the coronavirus outbreak, the revenue department said on Tuesday. In Maryland, the chief doctor of a Baltimore hospital's critical care unit has died after contracting the coronavirus. Joseph Costa, who worked at Mercy Medical Center, died Saturday, the news outlet reported. He was 56 years of age. In Branson, Missouri, the popular tourist town will require face coverings in most public places to slow the spread of the coronavirus, despite the objections of many, including comedian Yakov Smirnoff. In Concord, New Hampshire, state health officials and fire safety officials will spend the next 2 weeks investigating whether ventilation systems have contributed to coronavirus outbreaks at nursing homes, according to Governor Sununu. In New Jersey, three more states, plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, were added to the list where those traveling to New Jersey must quarantine for 2 weeks because of COVID-19. Illinois, Kentucky, Minnesota, along with the nation's capital and the Caribbean island, bring the total list of affected states and territories to 36. A county in New Mexico's southeastern oil production region is backing a legal challenge against a statewide ban on indoor dining amid surging coronavirus infections across the state. Eddy County filed a legal brief with the New Mexico Supreme Court in solidarity with restaurants that said Democratic Governor Michael Lujan Grisham has overstepped her authority under a stay-at-home order that bans indoor dining. In New York, Governor Cuomo said he is appalled by videos showing crowds standing close together at a Hamptons concert featuring electronic music duo The Chainsmokers over the weekend. Cuomo said the State Department of Health will conduct an investigation into egregious social distancing violations. In South Dakota, Kristi Noem, governor, said she will push for schools to stay open this fall as parents and school boards cautiously weigh the risks and the benefits of schools reopening. She emphasized the educational and social upside of a return to in-person learning, citing research that COVID-19 poses less of a threat to children. In Tennessee, Governor Bill Lee said reopening schools in person is the medically sound preferred option, but is dependent on quickly isolating those who are sick and quarantining their close contacts. In Texas, local health officials do not have the authority to close schools to prevent the spread of coronavirus, State Attorney General Ken Paxton said Tuesday, pushing that decision solely into the hands of school officials. In Wardsboro, Vermont, three staff members of a small Vermont library have resigned over plans to reopen the library. In a social media post, Wardsboro Library Director Jill Dean said the staff members would have liked to stay with curbside pickup for safety reasons, but the library trustees wanted to have the library open. And in Wisconsin, without a uniform mask law, Wisconsin cities and counties are left to decide on their own what to do. That has caused them many problems. Leaders of groups representing cities, villages, and counties told members of the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce Association on a telephone meeting Wednesday. And next is a story from the Tribune News Service. Black people still few and far between in the biotech industry. San Diego biotechs are working to erase cancer, light up nerves during surgery, and scan thousands of molecules with artificial intelligence. The industry's workforce, however, is less futuristic than its goals. Black people account for 6% of the county's overall workforce, but just 3% of biotech, according to the San Diego Workforce Partnership. Hispanics or Latinos, who represent a third of the country's workforce, make up 16% of biotech. To understand the dearth of diversity, we reached out to the past and present biotech employees, recruiters, and the county's research institute, the country's research institutes, universities, and colleges. People heightened several issues, highlighted several issues, including limited diversity in academic pipelines that feed into biotech, companies recruiting within their own network bubbles, and explicit and implicit bias in reviewing applications. And getting hired is just the beginning. Black people within the industry said they had to work even harder to get noticed and rewarded for taking on challenging projects that would allow them to climb the corporate ladder. That may explain why minorities are especially scarce at the highest rungs of biotech. None of these issues are new. Biotech's lack of diversity has been documented for more than 20 years, but the topic has taken on a new urgency lately. I think this is a good opportunity now, with George Floyd, where we can all go back and really reflect and find ways out of systemic racism, said Paul Mola, one of San Diego's few Black biotech chief executive officers. And by God, what many don't understand is that we all get better. The society gets stronger. The country gets stronger. Early challenges, the average San Diego biotech chief executive is 56 years old, according to a 2015 report by LiftStream, a United Kingdom life sciences executive search firm. But the barriers that keep Black people out of biotech started far earlier in life. A Union Tribune investigation showed that Black and Latino public school students seldom have teachers who look like them. That holds true through higher education, according to the National Center for Educational Statistics. I'm happy to mentor students from underprivileged backgrounds, said Guy Salveson, Dean of Stanford Brigham Prebys graduate program. But I'm an old white guy. I might say the right things, and I try to act on the right things, but I'm not the right kind of mentor. I don't have the same background. Having mentors and role models who look like you matters, says Jervon Hunter, a Black bioengineering graduate student at UC San Diego, who is working on new, minimally invasive ways to treat heart disease. It's a project that's hard to explain to family back in his hometown of Port Gibson, Mississippi, home to less than 2,000 people. Growing up, Hunter didn't know anyone in biotech or that such careers even existed. there's no one there to actually exemplify what that career is, so no one thinks to go into it, Hunter said. That creates a sort of self-fulfilling cycle, he says. You don't see yourself represented in a career, so you don't pursue it. And because you don't pursue it, you're not represented. In Hunter's case, a brochure from the University of Alabama at Birmingham that mentioned a biomedical engineering program piqued his interest. While at the university, Hunter noticed that some of his peers were joining labs as volunteers. I had no idea what that even entails, Hunter said. And then you find out that a lot of it is volunteer. If you're not having college paid for and you have to work a job, you can't really go and do these volunteer jobs. A numbers game, or maybe not, Hunter was able to land a position as a paid lab assistant, where he gained valuable research experience before applying to University of California, San Diego for graduate school. But the issues of access, representation, and cost that he points to partly explain why there are so few black students in the programs that train the next crop of biotech workers. The Union Tribune reached out to a number of local institutes. The percent of black students range from a 10-year average of 1.5% for UC San Diego's biotech-related doctoral programs to 4.5% for MiraCosta College's bachelor's in biomanufacturing. Percentages for programs at South Dakota State University, Sanford Burnham Presby's, and Scripps Research Institute hovered in the range of 3-4%. Experts call this the pipeline problem, the idea that there simply aren't enough qualified members of underrepresented groups to hire. You have been listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Thank you for listening to our program.